Turkey is attacking Kurdish militias that help the U.S. military fight ISIS in Syria.
People say all politics is local. In Turkey, I say all politics is domestic. All foreign policy is domestic.
It's a dangerous new chapter for Syrians who've already faced years of war.
It's very scary, and nobody knows what will happen.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, a cocaine trafficking trial here in the U.S., where the defendant is the brother of the Honduran president.
Hondurans are following this like it's the World Cup.
And on the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, kugel is the dish to break the fast.
Such an American expression of the dish, to take a Kellogg's breakfast cereal and top a noodle kugel with it. And it is delicious, by the way.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Turkey began its military offensive in northern Syria today. Jets were seen taking off from Turkey's Diyarbakir airbase. They're targeting Kurdish militias inside Syria, the same ones that fought with the U.S. military against ISIS. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced the military operation on Twitter. Soon after that, reports emerged from inside Syria that the bombing had begun. Osama Mohammed is a journalist in the city of Komshli in northern Syria. He says the area was hit with artillery fire and mortar bombs earlier today.
One of the villages near Komshli is empty now. There were some airstrikes there. And in Komshli now, everybody is scared. The family, the friends, or the civilians, they don't know where they will leave and flee to because all the area is targeted. It's very scary. And nobody knows what will happen.
Mohammed says people there feel betrayed by President Trump's decision to withdraw American troops from the region.
Everybody is waiting for President Trump to have a new decision about Northeast Syria and forbid the new massacres and genocide against the people who are living here. Not only the Kurds, the Arabs, the Christians, the Yazidis, everybody in Northeast Syria.
Turkey's president says the offensive is going after terrorist groups, including the Islamic State, the Turkish-Kurdish separatist group known as the PKK, and their Syrian allies, the YPG. Mustafa Akyol is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. You're from Turkey, but you're a critic of Erdogan. How united is Turkey right now? What is the opposition saying about all this?
Well, interestingly, opposition parties, with one exception, the pro-Kurdish party, are also supporting this move, a bit reluctantly, but you know they don't want to look weak on, I think, national security. And the fight with the PKK, which is Turkey's main terrorist problem, is always popular in Turkey. And it is a never-ending war, so I'm among the people that there is no military solution to this problem and there should be a political solution. But now Turkey is in a very hawkish mood against the terrorists. And therefore, I think, unfortunately, it's a popular move.
And Erdogan's statement that I quoted a moment ago, that destroying the terror corridor on Turkey's southern border, I mean, is that a fair explanation of what Turkey's goals are here?
I mean, to some extent, in the sense that, let me tell you one thing. I mean, in Washington, in the West, people are discussing about the Kurds in Syria or the Kurds in the region. Whereas I think we need more nuance. I mean, there's an Iraqi Kurdish region in northern Iraq, and Turkey doesn't have a problem with this. It actually had pretty good relations for a long time. The Kurdish group in Syria, the armed group, which is a part of the Syrian Democratic Forces right now, is an ideological affiliate of the PKK, which is fighting a terrorist war against Turkey since 1980s. And when Turkish people look into Syria, they see the same flag, the same slogans, the same photo of the leader, Öcalan. So there is a PKK istan being created on the Syrian border. So that's, I think, a legitimate concern of Turkey that has not been rightly always understood in the past few years in the West. However, to think that you can enter into Syria, create a zone which will be free from this, and you can keep that zone, that is another idea. And I don't think that's a good solution, that will not achieve anything. But I think President Erdogan is doing this to look tough on terrorism at a time when his popularity is declining. Also, he has this idea, which is also, I think, concerning to me, that Syrian refugees inside Turkey, at least some of them, more than a million of them, will be transferred to this quote-unquote safe zone. That also, I think, is a concerning idea.
I mean, it sounds like Erdogan has an immediate plan, and we're seeing it now going into this northern part of Syria. Longer term, it sounds like he's kind of building castles in the sky.
Well, yes. I mean, nobody really knows what this plan will achieve. People say all politics is local. In Turkey, I say all politics is domestic. All foreign policy is domestic. So I think a lot of people in Turkey suspect that President Erdogan is doing this to solve two issues that people always have in mind in Turkey, the refugees and terrorism. So he will look strong on those issues. And maybe soon after that, he will go for some early elections to further extend his mandate. So there might be some political calculations there as well.
So, Mustafa, what possibly then can be the long-term goal of this operation? Because Turkey can't seriously hope to occupy a slice of a neighboring country with a hostile armed population over many months or even years, right?
Turkey can't do this forever. I think at some point, President Erdogan will declare we achieved our goals. They might be hoping to come to an agreement involving Russia, Iran, and the Assad regime. Whether there will be a big gain or not, that depends. But I think in the meantime, we might have an election in Turkey, and President Erdogan might do better than what he would otherwise do.
Do Turks worry that any of this could revitalize ISIS? Because they've been victims as much as anybody else of ISIS attacks.
Interestingly, there's less discussion about that. I think people trust that if the Turkish military is there, things will be under control. The chaos that can happen in the meantime, I haven't seen much discussion about that. Mm. And interestingly, ISIS is, of course, a terrorist group by Turkish definitions. Turkey has fought ISIS. That's something people forget. But on the other hand, in the Turkish public consciousness, still the number one terrorism problem in the world is PKK.
Mustafa Akyol at the Cato Institute in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Batteries. You've probably got a few rolling around in a junk drawer somewhere, charged and dead. But today in Stockholm, battery technology was elevated to one of the loftiest places in science.
This year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry rewards the development of lithium-ion batteries. We have gained access to a technical revolution.
The Nobel Prize for Chemistry went to three scientists, John Goodenough, Stanley Whittingham, and Akira Yoshino, for their groundbreaking work on lithium-ion batteries. Lightweight, rechargeable, and powerful, these are the batteries that have transformed daily life for countless people around the world. Sarah Snagarup-Lindsay is with the Nobel Selection Committee.
The laureates developed lightweight batteries of high enough potential to be useful in many applications. Truly portable electronics, mobile phones, pacemakers, but also long-distance electric cars.
As I mentioned, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry went to three men. Among all of the 2019 prizes announced so far this week in physics, chemistry, and medicine, none of the winners are women. In fact, with more than 600 Nobel Prizes handed out in the sciences, only 20 have gone to women. Add to that a Me Too controversy from last year, a sexual harassment scandal caused the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences not to award a prize for literature in 2018. As the world's Rupert Shenoy reports, the effort to diversify Nobel winners is slow going.
The group that gives out the Nobels holds a press conference the same day it announces winners.
Welcome to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences.
Last year, Canadian Donna Strickland won for physics for her work on lasers. She answered questions by phone and got one that male winners don't get.
You are the third woman ever getting the Nobel Prize in physics.
Is that all? Really?
What's your comments on that?
Okay. I thought there might have been more, but I couldn't think.
Strickland was the first woman to receive a Nobel for physics in 55 years.
I don't know what to say. I'm honored to be one of those women.
We expect more to come. More.
That last voice was Professor Göran Hansen, Secretary General of the Swedish Academy. He had just announced new measures to improve the representation of women among prize winners. Hansen had sent a letter to scientists asking them to take geography and gender into consideration in their nominations. At the time, Hansen told the journal Nature that he couldn't do more because of a covenant laid down by the original funder of the prizes, Alfred Nobel, who invented dynamite. Nobel explicitly said nationality shouldn't be considered in awarding winners. As Hansen emphasized at the 2018 press conference,
it's important to remember that the Nobel Prize is awarded for discoveries and inventions, and those who receive it have made major contributions to humankind, and that's why they get the prize.
Now, there's no way to know who's been nominated. Names of nominees are kept confidential for 50 years. So, at that 2018 press conference, a reporter asked Hansen just for a percentage. How many women were among the total nominees? Hansen said he didn't have that in front of him.
It's a small percentage, that's for sure. And that's why we're taking measures to encourage more nominations, because we don't want to miss anyone.
His Academy colleague, physics professor Olga Botner, added, the percentage is small because a few decades ago, there were many fewer women in science.
So the number has been increasing steadily over the years, but the number of nominations rather reflect the percentages as they were, say, two or three decades back in time.
Thank you. Good point.
But is it? Lieslotte Jaufred looked at exactly that. Jaufred is an associate physics professor at the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen.
So I think it was a dinner table discussion. Is it just by random that they only choose men?
So she and her colleagues used historical data and modeling to find out if the smaller number of women in scientific fields fully accounts for the low number of female Nobel laureates. They published a paper about it. The results, Jaufred says, are clear. Even historically accounting for fewer women in the sciences, women are underrepresented among Nobel Prize winners.
With 95% probability, there is a bias against women.
And there are plenty of examples of women who seem to have deserved the Nobel Prize.
I'm not sure how familiar you are with the story of Lisa Meitner.
Claudia Rankins is co-founder of the Society of STEM Women of Color. She's also a program officer at the National Science Foundation, but these are her personal views. She's talking about Lisa Meitner, the Austrian physicist who, Rankins argues, discovered nuclear fission. She fled Nazi persecution, but refused to work on the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb. Her teammate, Otto Hahn, was awarded the Nobel Prize for their work in 1944.
And that's just one example. I'm sure you can find throughout history and even now many other examples where men and women work side by side and the man gets the prize.
The Swedish Academy can't give Nobels to those who might have been overlooked. Their own rules don't allow posthumous awards. Women and people of color are still underrepresented in many scientific fields, and they don't rise as fast. Rankins points out that when Donna Strickland won the physics Nobel last year, she was still an associate professor at her college, despite her accomplishments. Recent studies have suggested that women have been winning more awards, but those awards often pay less, are lower status, and have to do with teaching, not research. Rankins says being a woman or minority in a largely white male field can still be a daily hardship.
And takes a toll on your health and well-being. And then for somebody to say, there are only white men scientifically advanced enough to be worthy of the Nobel Prize, just sort of adds insult to injury.
Good morning.
Today,
welcome to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences.
As the Nobel Committee announced its prize for chemistry to three men, they didn't get any questions about women's representation among Nobel winners. As for Donna Strickland, the physicist who won the Nobel last year, she was promoted to full professor within weeks of the announcement. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The Nobel Peace Prize is maybe the most prestigious of the awards to be announced in Oslo this week. Tomorrow, The World's Carolyn Biela reports on the frontrunner. That's teen climate activist Greta Thunberg from Sweden. She has gotten a lot of attention lately, even musical tributes.
Right here, right now.
That's a moment from Greta Thunberg's UN speech from last month, as sampled by Fatboy Slim. He played it in his show over the weekend in Gateshead, England. Thunberg's demand that world leaders take action right here, right now, fit nicely into the DJ's 1999 track by the same name.
The world is waking up, and change is coming, whether you like it or not. Thank you.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Women in Iran have a request, and it's not a big one.
We just want to watch a football game. not more. Not any political pretest, not any social pretest, just a football game.
And by football, she means soccer, of course. That was a woman I spoke with from Tehran. She's 35 years old, and tomorrow, for the first time in her life, she plans to walk into a stadium and watch a men's soccer game.
I think it's a very, very huge excitement.
She didn't want us to use her name on the air. She says she's worried she could get in trouble with the Iranian government for speaking with us. And that's why, despite what she says, this does seem political. Women in Iran have been banned from attending men's games for almost 40 years. Women's rights activists have been pushing the government to lift the ban for a long time. That pressure ramped up last month after the death of Sahar Khodayari, who's also known as the Blue Girl. She was arrested for sneaking into a stadium in protest. She set herself on fire. Her death had an impact on many Iranians.
I think many of the women who go to the stadium tomorrow is because of Sahar, and on behalf of Sahar, we go there.
Another woman in Tehran told us pretty much the same thing. She's a 24-year-old soccer fan. She also didn't want us to use her name. She says what happened to the Blue Girl was important. She says it was the news of the death of the Blue Girl that got the attention of FIFA, the international governing body for soccer. FIFA threatened to punish Iran if they did not let women inside soccer stadiums. Many see it as a positive step, but it does not go far enough. Around 3,500 tickets out of a possible 100,000 were set aside for women. The 24-year-old fan in Tehran says the tickets went so quickly she couldn't get one. But she'll be going to the stadium tomorrow to take photos and videos with other women who couldn't get in. There's one other thing about tomorrow that bothers the first fan we spoke with.
Unfortunately, they want to put us in the cage.
She got a ticket, but she'll have to sit in a section that will be surrounded by a fence to keep the women separate from male fans. Despite the downsides, she's still excited, and she's the proud owner of a new horn in the colors of the Iran flag. Of course, I had to ask her about that. Is it like one of those horns they had at the South Africa World Cup they call a vuvuzela?
yes, something like that.
What's the word for vuvuzela in Farsi?
We called it Sheipur.
Sheipur.
Yes.
All right, well, make a lot of noise. Yeah, in a way, she already is. There's a political drama playing out for Honduras, but it's happening in a courtroom in New York. Honduran politician Juan Antonio Tony Hernandez is standing trial. He's accused of smuggling tons of cocaine into the United States under the protection of his brother, Juan Orlando Hernandez. Juan Orlando also happens to be the president of Honduras. This is not the first time Honduran officials have been implicated in drug trafficking, but this particular trial is something different, according to many Hondurans.
There has been a lot of politicians involved with drug dealers in Honduras, and nothing has been done. I'm waiting for the verdict. But of course, there has to be deep, profound reforms in Honduras. And hopefully this case is the turning point. This case is the critical juncture where politicians and the economic elites change the way of concentrating power and wealth in the country right now.
That's Lester Ramirez from the NGO Transparency International, speaking from the capital, Tegucigalpa. Journalist Jeff Ernst is also based there, but we reached him in New York, where he's been inside the courtroom every day covering the trial.
Hondurans are following this like it's the World Cup. For many, it's simply confirmation of what they've long believed, that the narco traffickers have infiltrated the state all the way to the highest levels. Others have a more wait-and-see attitude, but everybody, regardless of their ideology, is sitting on pins and needles waiting to see what happens in court each day.
Given the reports about the violence many Hondurans are fleeing from, what do the charges mean for their daily lives?
Hondurans have a justice system that doesn't work. Several of these narco traffickers, who are now confessed narco traffickers, testifying in trial and were allegedly associates of Tony Hernandez, no investigation was ever opened against them in Honduras. Particularly notable in the case of Alexander Ardón, whose testimony we heard this week, it was an open secret. There were news reports as far back as 2011 of him being involved in narco trafficking. He was mayor of a small town along the border with Guatemala. Everybody knew what he was up to, yet nothing ever happened to him in Honduras. Mm. And now we're seeing in court why.
And Hondurans are waiting on pins and needles with this trial because they think something will change in Honduras?
They hope something would change. Honduras has a unique relationship with the U.S. They kind of look for the U.S. to give it direction. Many don't understand that the U.S. would never indict a sitting president. So many think that, oh, if Tony Hernandez is convicted, then Juan Orlando would be next and they'll take him out. And that's just not going to happen. But more than anything, it's confirmation of the government's own complicity in this drug trafficking trade that helped make the country one of the world's most violent.
Right. Well, I mean, this is all happening as the Honduran government is facing immense pressure from the White House to halt migration to the United States. Mm-hmm. And just last week, Trump posed for photos in New York with the Honduran president. They celebrated a deal that would require Honduras to take in more asylum seekers. You're living there in Honduras, I mean, what do you think, Jeff? Is it a safe third country for asylum seekers?
The Honduran government doesn't have the capacity to care for its own citizens, much less any sort of asylum seekers. And the idea of Honduras being a safe country for migrants, which is a particularly vulnerable population, is pretty laughable.
And how safe is Honduras for journalists like yourself? I mean, this trial in New York has brought back the legacy of cartel lord El Chapo Guzman. It was not wise to cross him, either as a competitor in trafficking, as a government official, or a journalist.
Local journalists certainly face a lot of danger. Honduras is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for journalists. So a lot of them just simply avoid these subjects. They don't write about drug trafficking. They don't write about corruption. And that helps foment the impunity that really reigns in Honduras. For me personally, I'm an American. I enjoy certain privileges and more protection just of that. But for the local journalists, there's definitely a culture of fear that leads to self-censorship often because they don't want to expose themselves to the threats or potential danger to them or their families. It's definitely very serious and one of the most difficult places, at least in this hemisphere, to do journalism.
Reporter Jeff Ernst, who's usually based in Honduras but has been speaking with us from New York, where he's covering the drug trafficking trial of Juan Antonio Hernandez, the brother of the president of Honduras. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You're with the world. In Hong Kong, protesters are feeling the threat of violence and they're taking precautions.
What's in the backpack?
I can't tell you, but at least I can defend myself.
The threat is not just coming from the police, it's also coming from the Hong Kong Mafia. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. They come out at night, mobs of men, often wearing matching T-shirts. They're usually holding sticks, and they're looking to beat up Hong Kong's protesters. In many cases, these groups are connected with Hong Kong's triads. They're gangsters, secret societies that go back hundreds of years. But what do they have against Hong Kongers protesting for more autonomy? The World's Patrick Nguyen looked for answers. And a quick note here, this story does include some scenes of violence.
I'm outside a concrete building, looking up this dark, narrow stairwell. Here to meet a man with a price on his head. I find his office. He leads me inside, into a back room, and explains that
I do think that I must be one of the main targets. The gangsters may ambush me.
That's Lam Chuk Ting. He's 42, an elected official in Hong Kong's government. And the gangsters he mentioned, let's just say they could easily spot him in a crowd, because Lam is 6'4".
In Hong Kong, I'm quite tall, and therefore I have been cautious.
Lam is a lawmaker with Hong Kong's Democratic Party, and his problems with the local mafia, well, it all started 11 weeks ago, on a night that's now infamous in Hong Kong. That evening, he gets a text message from a constituent. It says, hey, did you know there's a mob of armed men gathering outside the local train station? Lam and his assistants go check it out. And they see about 100 guys, all in matching white t-shirts, holding sticks, surrounding people who've just come back from a protest against China's tightening grip over Hong Kong. So Lam and his team, they start recording on their phones. Pretty soon after that,
more than 100 white-shirted gangsters stormed into the station, and they used batons, steel bars, and wooden sticks.
They're just thrashing people, senior citizens, teenagers. One reporter there, Gwyneth Ho, she's filming and they just knock her to the floor. To her credit, she gets back up and keeps reporting. The mob chases people all the way to the train cars, trapping them inside, still hitting them with sticks, even as people get on their knees and beg.
That was the most horrifying moment of the attack.
By the time the mob leaves, there's blood all over the train station. Almost 50 are injured, including Lam. His mouth is bleeding, and the bones in his right hand are fractured from blocking attacks. And here's where this takes an even darker turn. Before the attack, when the mob was just showing up, people were frantically calling the police, Lam included. An officer told him, "Yes, sir, we're on it." And yet, at the train station, the police seemed to hang back.
When they arrived, they just made a U-turn and left,
leading Lam and many others to conclude,
"The police allowed the gangster to attack civilians indiscriminately that night."
Police turning a blind eye to criminals. But why?
The police may think that those protesters were troublemakers. So if they need assistance, I will not help.
Police deny this, of course, saying they were stretched thin from deploying to all the protests across the city. And saying cops colluded with gangsters. It's a huge allegation, and not one that Lam is making lightly. Because he's actually a former agent with Hong Kong's anti-corruption squad, which investigates dirty cops, like cops who get mixed up with gangsters. But okay, let's rewind a bit. These gangsters are known as triads, Chinese secret societies, some tracing their origins back to the 1800s, to mainland China, where many triads in Hong Kong still have deep connections. Today, they are these illegal brotherhoods that do, well, gangster stuff, such as
drug trafficking, illicit gambling, and also prostitution. They do some loan sharking as well.
That is Sharon Kwok, a criminologist from Hong Kong, now at Western Sydney University. Kwok specializes in triads, so she spent a lot of time with them. She says they obey a strict hierarchy. They're ruled by leaders called dragon heads, men with names like Broken Mouth or Baby or Shanghai Boy. Yes, those are actual people. Triads also run legitimate businesses, Kwok says. Real estate, mahjong parlors, bus companies, even catering.
Yeah, what matters is whether it makes money or not.
Okay, but beating up protesters, where's the money in that? Well, Kwok says they also do a lot of
contract violence, like paying them for attacking someone.
Contract violence. Now, unlike American gangs, they're not necessarily using guns. Think more like hatchets, iron rods, brass knuckles. But Kwok says they will hurt or kill you for a price. So maybe they were paid for the attack. Or it's possible they do it just to curry favor with powerful people who run the city, the pro-Beijing elite, who revile the protesters. Getting on their good side is good for business. And besides, Kwok says, most triads already agree that protesters are traitors to Mother China.
They're very patriotic, and that's why they would regard protesters as someone who tried to overthrow the Chinese rule or the Hong Kong government, and that's why they hate them.
But what about the police? Aren't cops supposed to be locking up gangsters? Kwok says not always. Police talk to triads, use them as their eyes and ears on the streets, especially in certain neighborhoods where triads see everything that moves.
It's very, very important for the police to have contacts within the triad networks. It's for both controlling them and also for collecting intelligence.
Is that proof that police deliberately allowed triads to bash protesters? No, That's why Lam and many others demand an investigation, because triad-style attacks on protesters, they keep happening. Just 3 weeks ago, a gang of guys, again in white t-shirts, charged at protesters, one slamming them with a steel chair, like a wrestling move. Or sometimes they just come out to taunt them, saying, "Hey, come at us, we'll beat you to death." Sometimes cops do show up when this happens, but end up glad-handing with the attackers and letting them go. So now, when protesters see a cop on the streets, they just start screaming the word triads. Haksewoi, literally dark society. This is a full-blown crisis, because Hong Kong's police, long seen as the finest in Asia, were beloved by Hong Kongers. But now, polls show that half the population has zero trust in the cops. The protesters, not all of them are waiting for an investigation. Some are going vigilante, smashing businesses suspected of being triad-run, like this mahjong parlor. And they're spray-painting the numbers 721 all over town. July 21st, the night of the train station attack. Speaking of which...
Elsewhere in Hong Kong, police have so far arrested seven men involved in attacks at Yuen Long MTR station on Sunday.
Yep, police did track down some of the attackers, and guess what? They're in notorious triad gangs called Wo Xing Wo and 14K. Lam Chuk Ting, the lawmaker, his phone video of the assault was used as evidence. His buddies in the intelligence world are now saying, "You need to watch out. You're a wanted man." He told me the price on his head, asked me not to repeat it, but it's not a small amount. So he's worried. And yet when he most needs police protection...
We all know that we could not rely on the Hong Kong police force to protect ourselves.
So Lam tells me, kind of cryptically, that he now has this backpack that he takes everywhere.
What's in the backpack?
I can't tell you. But at least I can defend myself.
This, Lam says, is becoming the new Hong Kong.
We must reform our political system and the police force. If we fail, we don't think that we have any future and we have no hope.
For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Hong Kong.
And now to Ecuador. In the capital, Quito, today, indigenous-led protesters began a national strike after President Lenin Moreno refused to give in to their demands to step down. Businesses were closed, the streets of Quito and other cities were empty of traffic but full of protesters. Since October 3rd, violent demonstrations have rocked Ecuador after President Moreno cut government subsidies on gasoline and diesel. Yesterday in Quito, protesters briefly burst through police lines and entered the parliament building. In a short speech on Monday, President Moreno made a surprising announcement. His government was relocating from Quito to the coastal city of Guayaquil, nearly 300 miles away. The World's Maria Elena Romero has been reporting on the situation in Ecuador. So, Maria Elena, the protests have been massive. They've been violent. They've prompted Ecuador's president to relocate the government to another city. For many of us, this came out of the blue. How did this all start?
Well, Marco, last week, President Moreno announced a series of austerity measures, including the end of fuel subsidies that have been in place since the 1970s. And getting rid of those subsidies caused an immediate spike in gas and diesel prices. In fact, gas prices went up 100%.
Wow.
And this is why workers from the transportation sector, truckers and taxi drivers, went on strike for 2 days last week. Now, indigenous people are leading the protests.
So my understanding is that these fuel subsidies had been in place for the past 40 years. Why did President Moreno drop them?
So the cuts to the fuel subsidies are actually part of a larger austerity plan that Ecuador has to implement to comply with the International Monetary Fund. The IMF approved a $4.2 billion loan to Ecuador in March this year. So one of the first issues that President Moreno wanted to tackle was the $1.4 billion per year the government says it spends to keep gas prices low.
Now, it's been indigenous groups in Ecuador that have been leading these protests. Why are they front and center?
Basically because they fear they will be the most affected. I spoke to Andres Tapia, an indigenous leader from an organization called the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador. He says that indigenous groups will continue to lead the protests because it is people like them in poor and rural communities in Ecuador that will see higher fuel prices and probably higher food prices as well, and that will leave them with less money to take care of their families.
So indigenous groups are not just the ones most likely affected by these this drop in subsidies. I gather they've actually really been mobilizing the masses and making their voices heard in Quito. What have these groups been doing exactly?
On Monday night, in fact, just after the president announced he was leaving Quito with his administration, thousands of indigenous protesters arrived walking. They arrived in buses, in cars, and they are vowing to stay until the gas subsidies are restored.
Now, here's some sound from yesterday. What's going on here, Maria Elena?
They marched through the streets of Quito, chanting, holding long sticks and carrying Ecuadorian flags and the rainbow indigenous flag. And even briefly, a group of protesters occupied Ecuador's parliament. Since last night, there is a curfew in areas close to the government buildings in Quito, and a national state of emergency remains in place.
So despite the demands for him to step down, President Lenin Moreno has completely rejected that, but he is on the back foot, it seems. What's next for him?
President Moreno has very low popularity ratings, but he has the backing of the business elite and middle-class Ecuadorians. Right now, he's saying that he's open for dialogue, and he's hoping that either the United Nations or the Catholic Church can mediate the crisis. He's defending his reforms. He says he's making up for years of neglect that occurred under former President Rafael Correa, who increased salaries of government workers and had social and infrastructure projects that actually increased the national deficit.
The world's Maria Elena Romero, thanks very much for explaining all of this.
Thank you, Marco.
College students are encouraged to go meet their professors during office hours. It's an opportunity to help students succeed and get better grades. But new reporting from West Africa reveals a disturbing reality.
He's a respected lecturer. He's risen to be one of the top guys in the department. And so he comes across as a father figure that wants to protect you and help you through your journey in school, while he has ulterior motives.
Ulterior motives. Sexual harassment of female students at universities in Nigeria and Ghana is the subject of a new BBC documentary. It's called Sex for Grades. Journalists went undercover and collected video evidence on four male college professors. Reporter Kiki Morty led the investigation at the University of Lagos in Nigeria. She had backup safety measures while sitting in the office of one of the accused men.
I was there as a student. He didn't know that I had a secret panic button that was disguised as something else. I had to keep it professional at all times. But of course, we were told that at every point you feel uncomfortable, we had panic buttons. So just hit the panic button and we'll come get you.
All four university lecturers have been suspended since the report broke. Join us tomorrow when Kiki Morty talks about her investigative reporting on sexual harassment and the impact it's had. Today is Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. Jews around the world spend the day reflecting on their sins of the past year, and they refrain from all food. When they break the fast after sunset, it's usually with a feast. That means a table filled with bagels and lox, coffee, sweets, and kugel. This casserole dish can be a savory square of potatoes and onions or a sweet dessert full of noodles and cheese. So what is kugel anyway? Reporter Dina Pritchett dug into the rich story of this rich dish.
Sonia Sanford is the daughter of Jewish refugees from Ukraine. So it's no surprise that when it comes to kugel, she reaches for root vegetables.
Anytime there's some kind of fried potato around, I think of my grandmother's. And those smells, those textures are just so central to the cuisine I grew up eating.
Sanford runs Beetroot Market and Deli in Portland, Oregon. To make cagoula in Beetroot's kitchen, Sanford peels a mess of potatoes and onions, grates them, and seasons it well.
Generous salt, generous pepper.
She stirs in a few eggs, and then she heats up oil until it's screaming hot and pours it, carefully, directly into the batter.
And that's part of the secret to the texture of kugel. When you do add boiling hot oil to the batter, somehow, magically, it becomes softer.
And it's part of the secret of Eastern European peasant cooking in general.
You can turn your potato, that simple root vegetable with a little bit of onion, a little bit of egg, a little bit of pepper, into a red-letter feast, something that's so much more than the everyday.
Avery Robinson is a cultural and culinary historian who wrote his dissertation about kugel. This kugel transformation he talks about, from the everyday potato to a holiday specialty, is even immortalized in a Yiddish song.
Sunday potatoes, Monday potatoes, Tuesday and Wednesday potatoes, Thursday and Friday potatoes, but Shabbos on occasion. Ah, a potato kugel. Sunday, back to potatoes.
But despite the catchy tune, Robinson says kugel actually developed centuries before these New World potatoes were even a part of European cooking.
The earliest reference we know to kugel is from the 13th century in Germany, and it was essentially a dumpling.
Literally just dumplings, like bread dumplings, that were dropped into chullent, which is a Sabbath stew.
Leah Koenig is a food writer and cookbook author, most recently of The Jewish Cookbook. She says kugel eventually moved out of the stew pot and into its own little casserole dish, and went from being just fat and breadcrumbs to incorporating all sorts of ingredients.
So potato is definitely the most well-known, but you would see kugels made of rice, noodles, also sweet and savory. Today, you'll find everything from like broccoli to cauliflower, spinach.
Koenig says that to be kugel, you need to have three things: fat, starch, and eggs. Beyond that, it's pretty much a blank canvas. And the way you paint it tells the story of your family.
If you're Romanian, you may have a cornmeal one. If you come from a religious background, you're almost certainly going to have the Yerushalmi one with the caramelized sugar and the black pepper, because that developed in Jerusalem in the very religious communities.
If your family immigrated to the American South, it might be sweet potatoes. And if your family was in America in the 1950s, you might top your kugel with cornflakes.
I mean, that's such an American expression of the dish, to take a Kellogg's breakfast cereal and top a noodle kugel with it. And it is delicious, by the way. I mean, having that crunch is so wonderful.
Throughout history, throughout the world, people have made kugel their own. It's comfort food. Not just because of all the starch and fat and carbs, although those certainly don't hurt, but because it connects people with their past, with a sense of who they are. And for a lot of people, it wouldn't be a holiday without it. For The World, I'm Dina Pritchett.
And yes, we have recipes. Sonia Sanford's potato kugel recipe with a hot oil trick. Be careful when you try that at home. And Leah Koenig's recipe, her favorite, a Hungarian noodle kugel with jam and poppy seeds. They're both at theworld.org. Keeping the focus on food, if you've got a sad bunch of spinach wilting away in your fridge, you're not alone. Food waste is a huge problem around the globe. The United Nations estimates that about one-third of all food produced is thrown away. One supermarket chain in Finland called S-Market has an idea to change that. It's a happy hour. Every day at 9 p.m., groceries nearing their expiration dates get deep discounts, up to 60% off. Sari Rissanyemi is a manager at S-Market in charge of sustainability.
We had a goal that we need to reduce our food waste by 15% by the end of 2020. And we really wanted to find new ways and also to involve our customers in this effort. So we found out this idea, Happy Hour, would help our customers also to realize that it's okay to buy products which are close by their expiry day, and they are still good to use. So we tested the concept in some stores, and it actually worked fine. And it's now being used in all our stores in Finland.
Is this popular? Are you seeing lots of people flooding in at 9 just for that 60% off?
Yes, it's actually quite popular. You see a crowd gathering just before 9 o'clock And people go in early to find the products. And then when they hear the announcement in the loudspeakers, they go and buy the products from the cashier.
Here in the United States, I think a lot of food consumers believe that sell-by date is a hard and fast rule. Are attitudes changing there about kind of how much longer you can eat food past that date?
Yeah, we also tried that with our customers, that they would understand that best before doesn't mean that you have to throw out the food. So you can still use, and you can use your own senses to really try the food and try if you can still cook it.
Have you been able to estimate how much food waste has been diverted through this program?
Yes, we are measuring food waste in all of our stores very closely. In some of the stores, the reduction has been as high as 10% after they have started the program. Yearly, in all our stores, we sell something like 70 million discounted products. It means in every store, every day, about 200 products. Mm. And part of that will be sold minus 30 during the daytime and during the happy hour minus 60.
And I'm curious, sorry, has this program changed your own personal consumption and eating habits?
Definitely, yes. By this happy hour concept, I'm looking for the products in the shelves, and I might find something that I haven't used before with a very good price. So I'm trying that. And also, of course, in home, I'm really concerned if I have something getting old. I don't like that at all. So it has changed myself also, my thinking of food quality and respect of food and food loss.
You don't like the act of throwing food away, I gather.
No, not at all.
Sari Ristamniemi is the division manager for S-Market, a chain of supermarket stores in Finland. She's been speaking with us from Helsinki. Good luck with the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Waste not, want not, works in any language. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, thank you for listening. We'll see you here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.